and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. I know that we were here late last night with the bonding bill, so, and there are a couple of members in other committees that are presenting bills, so I apologize for the lighthouse, but we do have a long agenda today, and so in order to accommodate everybody, I think we need to get started. And so we're taking testimony on the governor's budget recommendations today, and we'll start with Michael Scandrett, to be followed by Dave Patterson.
Madam Chair, my name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, which represents the community mental health, community health centers, the dental clinics, safety net hospitals, and other healthcare providers and healthcare organizations that serve low-income and uninsured Minnesotans. The last time I testified before the committee, I was towards the end of the agenda, and there was nobody left. And today, I'm at the beginning of the agenda, and there's nobody here yet. But that's okay. I think everybody's just kind of, you know, not sure what to do next. So it's hard to get up in the morning and come and go to the hearings, I guess. I would want to make some more general comments about the governor's budget proposal and kind of basically just express my disappointment in the governor's decisions about how to proceed on this. I think in the past the governor has done some really impressive things in terms of his involvement in the Transformation Task Force, in proposing healthcare reforms, proposing mental health reforms, and actually leading efforts to have the legislature enact mental health reforms. And in the past, the governor's position has been to reform the system in a way that will reduce future costs and direct services and funding to the most cost-effective services, primarily in outpatient settings, things that will keep people from entering crisis. And unfortunately, the budget proposal goes in the exact opposite direction of the way the governor has advocated for addressing the Health and Human Services budget in the past. And in fact, I would go so far as to say it's fiscally irresponsible from the state's perspective in terms of actually doing things that will increase future state costs. And I know that it's a simpler thing to cut line items, but I had thought, based on the governor's past actions, that he was interested in reforming programs rather than just continuing to reduce costs. And we think with this budget proposal, we have reached the point where by simply cutting the line items, we're basically going to see the system disassembling, and very important parts of the safety net and the very healthcare system itself will no longer be there to serve everyone in the state, not just people on low-income programs. Some examples of this is some of the most cost-effective services that the governor and the department has acknowledged in the past is the importance of the community clinic system, the outpatient services, coverage for drugs for mental health treatment, the CD treatment for people that might otherwise be in a CD crisis. And the governor cuts these various services that in the past have been used to show savings and prevent future costs. Another example is in the decisions about taking people off of the Minnesota Care Program and making changes that will result in the loss of coverage for GAMC. It's basically shifting costs either to the counties or to the health care providers. And at the same time, by reducing the local aid to counties, there's no way for the counties to pick up that slack. And by reducing the payment rates made to the providers who will be seeing more uninsured patients, eliminating any method for the providers to serve that population other than to pass the costs on to privately insured individuals and employers who will pay a higher cost due to the higher rates of uncompensated care. In the past, too, there's been a commitment to trying to fund the basic services through safety net providers as an approach to keep a last resort system in place. This budget eliminates the critical access dental program and other community clinic grants that are actually needed more now than ever in order to keep up with the pace of the growth in the uninsured. And this will kind of go directly at those last resort services and eliminate the capacity that we've always had in the state to be sure that services are provided. Another example that's hard for me to understand is to eliminate the coverage for GAMC recipients, move them into Minnesota Care with the expectation that they would pay the premium, and then cut the general assistance grants that provide the money that people would need to pay for those premiums. So it's hard to understand how that will work as well. So I wish that the governor would have actually remained true to his past positions and in the past, just to, if he needs a reminder of what he's advocated for in the past. He's talked about the importance of doing healthcare reform to prevent future increases in healthcare costs. There's no reform in his proposal at all. He has supported funding the basic primary care and outpatient services that are important to preventing increases in inpatient and emergency room use. He's advocated for not shifting costs to private sector employers and individuals and not to underpay providers in a way that does accelerate that shift to the private sector, and also to support funding and programs to improve the health of the population. And in this budget proposal, he actually eliminates funding that's designed to prevent future costs by investing in public health and prevention programs. So I think we all here know that it's really hard work to reform the system, and it's really difficult to go in and find ways to do this, especially when money is short. But again, I'll just repeat what the governor said in the past, is that you really have to make these reforms in order for us to be able to have a sustainable system in the future. And it's not reform to simply cut line items and payment rates and eliminate programs. It requires engaging in the system itself and developing reforms that can be put in place now, even though it takes a little longer for them to pay off. But if we don't do that, we're going to continue to be in worse and worse situations each year and continue to be back here trying to find Band-Aid solutions to problems that are systemic. Thank you, Madam Chair. Be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Scandrett. Are there any questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Mr. Scandrett, I just wanted to publicly acknowledge the Safety Net Coalition and thank you in all of the efforts that have been undertaken, particularly on trying to seek a resolution to GAMC.
Thank you, Senator.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Dave Patterson, to be followed by Tricia Stark. Is Dave Patterson here? Is Tricia Stark here?
My name is Tricia Stark, and I'm a licensed psychologist and Director of Professional Affairs for the Minnesota Psychological Association. I'm going to tell you a story, a brief story, about the effects of the governor's budget, that what it would have on one of my clients. I'll call her Ann, and I'm disguising her aspects for confidentiality. She's 62, has worked all her life at a minimal wage, but has not worked in 2 years. She is seriously and persistently mentally ill. She just began taking Social Security because she has little to live on. She was paying $700 a month for health insurance out of her unemployment and savings, but was told by an advisor that she couldn't afford that, that it was too expensive. She would run out of money, so she had to cancel her health insurance and stop taking some of her medications, putting her health in peril. She's thrilled that after 8 months, she's gotten Minnesota Care, paying $100 a month for a premium. I don't want to have to tell her that she's going to lose her health insurance because she makes more than $8,000 a year, because she will no longer have health insurance because the governor's plan is to change from 275 to 75% of poverty for single adults. Her medications alone cost $500 a month. Minnesota's uninsurance rate is at 9%. Do we really want to increase these rolls by removing single adults from Minnesota care. It seems very unfair to balance our budget on the backs of the least fortunate and most vulnerable. Removing emergency general assistance, reforming general assistance, the uncertainty in the outcome of GAMC, all of these have a very human toll. They're not just numbers on a page. All of us need to tighten our belt, but the burden should not fall disproportionately on those to whom society has a responsibility to ensure the common good. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you again. Laura Campbell, to be followed by Alexandra Fitzsimmons.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Laura Campbell. I manage an adult day program for the Volunteers of America of Minnesota in Southwest Minneapolis. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Adult Day Services Association. MADSA supports adult day programs that help provide people to stay in their communities without social isolation while providing necessary support for their caregivers. MADSA must voice its opposition to the proposed 2.5% reduction in payments for services for the elderly and disabled. We have struggled to deliver economical community services, but we've been faced with so many cuts and so few cost of living adjustments in the past 8 years that another cut will bring our rate levels back to little more than in 2002. This is 2010, and we're having a harder time hiring and sustaining quality staff and delivering the quality care our seniors deserve. Licensing and COA requires people with extensive experience and college degrees. Workers on average make $10 to maybe $15 per hour. Many of our part-time employees don't receive benefits like pension or extended vacation time. MADSA has surveyed its members' current centers twice since the 2.58% cuts took effect in July 2009. Clients are losing formally authorized services, and our morale is very bad. Our staff is dedicated, and they work really hard. They meet the needs of participants with a variety of mental health issues and physical disabilities. They want to stay in their jobs, but it's very hard when they can't make enough to support their families. They need to be valued and compensated for the work they do. Every time we lose a staff person, it costs a minimum of $500 to replace that person in terms of advertising and in training. Training and staff ratios have been determined by the legislature. The Minnesota baby boomer generation turned 65 starting last year, so they're here. And ours is a comparatively healthy state, but the risk of needing assistance with daily care rises with age. If people who need assistance have to go to residential facilities or stay at home all day with supervision because adult day isn't an option, the costs are going to get higher. The following figures have been taken from the 2009 MetLife Mature Market Institute study. The average daily cost of a semi-private room in the Twin Cities area nursing homes is $148. The average cost for a one-bedroom assisted living apartment is $82 for room and board, and that does not include supportive care like nursing services and other daily needs. And that would bring the total up as each service is added in. The average cost for a home health aide is $27 per hour. Times 8 hours would be higher than a nursing home, although the staffing is one-to-one. The MetLife study lists the average adult day service rate in the Twin Cities as $74 per day. If a person attends my program, 5 days per week is $318. Many participants need full-time but can delay nursing home placement by attending only part-time. If working caregivers cannot count on day services for loved ones, they may have to give up their jobs to care for their loved ones at home. This means increased unemployment, people going without health insurance and other benefits. The legislature has made a commitment to cost-effective services for our seniors. To do this, we need a strong community programs with qualified and consistent workers, which the governor's plan puts in jeopardy. Thank you for letting me come today.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thanks again for the work you do. Alexandra Fitzsimmons, to be followed by Mark McAfee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I am the policy director for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The MCC is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church throughout Minnesota. Minnesota's budget is a moral document. The way we balance our state's income and expenditures speaks volumes about the quality of justice in our community. All people have a fundamental right to the basic material necessities that are required to live with human dignity. Our community has a special obligation to ensure that our sisters and brothers with the greatest needs are not denied these basic economic rights. Food, shelter, health care, employment, education. These are so fundamental that they are human rights. The protection of these rights takes precedence over other competing social and economic claims. This is the type of moral framework that should govern the difficult budget decisions that lie ahead for our state. We do not question the fact that the budget debate must deal with difficult economic realities. We cannot accept, however, the assumption that budget cuts are the only acceptable way to respond to the $1.2 billion budget deficit. By relying almost exclusively on budget cuts, Governor Pawlenty's budget would ultimately mean reductions in programs that are essential, critical, to our neighbors who are the poorest and most vulnerable. Many of the governor's proposed $347 million in cuts to the Health and Human Services area will have destructive effects on our neighbors who are already struggling. In the interest of time, I will briefly touch upon two of the governor's harmful proposals. First, the elimination of the General Assistance Program. This critical safety net program provides needed assistance to Minnesotans who are unable to work. This cut would be devastating to our 19,000 neighbors who rely on the meager $203 they receive from GA per month. Without this monthly income, our poorest and most vulnerable neighbors will not have access to other income. It's also important to note that many Minnesotans who receive GA are homeless. Not only are we called to consider the human impact of each and every economic decision, but we are called to place first, and never last, our sisters and brothers with the greatest needs. Like the elimination of GAMC last session, targeting Minnesotans whose voices oftentimes are not heard is unjust. Second, reducing eligibility for MinnesotaCare from 250% of the federal poverty guidelines to 75% of federal poverty guidelines for adults without children. This change in eligibility would end health care coverage for approximately 21,500 working Minnesotans who do not have access to affordable health care coverage through their employer. The savings to the Health Care Access Fund from this change in eligibility would then be transferred to the general fund to help balance our state's budget deficit. This is unacceptable. Access to affordable health care is a basic human right. As such, we cannot jeopardize the health and well-being of our neighbors in order to balance our state's budget. Our economy must serve people, not the other way around. Our state's budget defines what we as a community value and also what we don't. In the coming months, all of us must work together to ensure that the current budget deficit does not become an excuse for ignoring or denying the pressing needs of our neighbors with the greatest needs. Thank you for your time and your commitment to Minnesota.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Mark McAfee, to be followed by Ellie Skelton.
Madam Chair, members of the division, I am Mark McAfee, legislative representative for AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 workers throughout Minnesota, including state, county, municipal, school district, university, hospital, and long-term care workers. The governor's budget reads like a Charles Dickens novel. He cuts programs for those afflicted with mental illness and chemical dependency, slashes programs for children. He whacks services for the disabled and the elderly. He knocks the poor down. They need a hand up. All that is missing from this story is a debtor's prison. Here are some items of concern. Services for the mentally ill that are cut in the governor's budget include closure of a yet-to-be-named state-operated services mental health facility with a reduction of staff of 29 full-time equivalent positions. The unallotment of $5 million in state-operated services is made permanent. Legislators and the public will deserve an update on how and where changes will be made through the redesign before final decisions are made. We hope you'll see to that, Madam Chair. Grants to counties for children's mental health case management are reduced under this budget, as are grants to counties for housing supports and case management for adults with serious mental illness. As was mentioned a bit ago, adult mental health day treatment hours would be reduced. Elderly and disabled persons needing continuing care will see a decline in services and worsening care if the governor's proposal to cut all long-term care provider rates by 2.5% stands. This will hit MSOC's group homes. We have a couple of our workers here today. ICFMR, such as Lake Owosso residents, and nursing homes hard. It may accelerate closure of some facilities. Services for the chemically dependent will see a 5% cut to providers starting in FY 2011. Children and their families will be hit by 5% cuts to the basic sliding fee child care grants and 5% cut to the child care assistance program. This is tough not only on those families and those providers, but also it's tough during this tough economic time when people are trying to stay employed or to get jobs. State grants to counties for child support administrative costs would be eliminated. The governor's unallotment of block grants to counties to help provide social services for children, adolescents, and others would be extended. That's, I think, about a $45 million hit. A couple of other points. Healthcare services and research would also be cut. Part of the cigarette tax money now used for medical education and research grants would be stubbed out. Hospitals would take an inpatient rate reduction. People will come in and out of Minnesota care if they qualify, like a revolving door, and slam up against the $10,000 inpatient limit. Financial programs for the poor, like general assistance and work supports for the MFIP participants, are cut. How will people pay for Minnesota care co-pays or premiums without GA? What will they do? Where will they stay? During this time of severe recession, people need the safety net that many health and human services programs offer. We should be maintaining these programs rather than cutting them and finding new revenue sources to mitigate budget cuts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions?
I do.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
Madam Chair and Mr. McAfee, yeah, it sounds pretty bad. Do you have any solutions?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Coring, we know that they'll have to be tough decisions made as far as priority and some cuts, but we've been among the folks, the groups that have advocated for at least some rises in revenue, and we hear, of course, the governor doesn't want to take anything. Everything's a non-starter. We went through quite a bit on general assistance medical care. We had, I think, a pretty reasonable funding source there, which would have drawn federal funds. The governor wouldn't go for that. Apparently, he'll take federal money if he can get it to help balance his budget out there. But, you know, some of these were pretty reasonable, we thought. And we think at least part of the solution to mitigate the cuts ought to be through increased revenues. Madam Chair, Senator Coring.
Senator Coring?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want this to sound harsh, but it you know, I don't know if it was last year or was when the House came up and had some, they had meetings all over the state, and they actually came to Brainerd, and there was probably 150 people at this meeting, and really kind of doing the same thing that we're doing today. We were hearing from everybody, and out of those 150 people, there was only two people there that were not advocating for public programs. The rest of the people that that are working hard to try to feed their family, they didn't have a chance that was during the day, like today, where they didn't have a chance to come and give their input on what's happening. And I guess if I asked everybody that's in here that to raise their hand, if they're either were advocating for a public program or if they're just everybody here is advocating for a public program where, do you understand my point in that, Mr. McAfee? I guess I'm just looking, sure. And believe me, we know we're in difficult times and I want to hear from everybody, but to go through 35 different people, I guess I'd like to hear what they would do if they were in my position on how they would try to fix it. So,
well, Madam Chair, Senator Coring, first of all, a number of the people that come before you today and into the next couple of days, are some of them are going to be from, nonprofit organizations. There's a lot of private effort that goes through to match public programs. But also, I think, I don't mean to be harsh, but I think it would be a very interesting exercise if up in Morrison County we eliminated all public funding, such as the Federal Farm Program, take it all out of there. And I think you would find that there would be a huge reaction to that. We have those programs to help provide a stable base for, on top of that, then people can do their private sector jobs, businesses, et cetera. I wouldn't argue with you that it's important that we have private sector employment, but these sorts of programs are there in many cases because the private sector can't make a profit out of dealing with some really tough clients, et cetera. So we can talk more, perhaps.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just like to respond to what Senator Coring said, because it's interesting how maybe sitting on the different side of the political aisle, you can be at the same exact meeting and come away with it, from it with an entirely different perspective. I would say, because I was at that meeting too, that we heard, I thought it was from more than two people who were saying, no more taxes, no more taxes. But we heard for sure from a significantly greater number of people who talked specifically about the devastating cuts that we've made at the state level already before making these much deeper cuts. And these were not people who were unemployed and just weren't working because they were, didn't feel like working that day. They were people who, teachers and others who understand very well how we have been basically disassembling the infrastructure for things that are very important to that community. And so, Senator Coring, from my perspective, those people who were all working during the day took time off of their jobs to come there. If we would have had an evening meeting, I wouldn't be surprised to see the same proportion of people concerned about those kinds of things. We also talk about the issue of new revenue. And we talk about, people who are unemployed being hurt because we're talking about raising their taxes. Well, I have never heard anyone here talk about the idea that we would be raising taxes on unemployed and low-income people. These are the people, however, who, when they lose their jobs, need programs like GAMC or if they can't work, or Minnesota Care or other unemployment benefits to help them transition back to when our economy is in a better time. So if, these are the people who rely on those work, that the Minnesota Care, which is a program for working Minnesotans that is disproportionately used in our area, if we dismantle that program, as the governor has been proposing, that's going to put a lot of working Minnesotans in our area out of the ability to pay for health care. So, I guess I'm very concerned about that.
Senator Olson, I'd just like to call your attention to the length of the agenda today.
I'm sorry.
And I'd like to remind you that we will have plenty of time for the committee to have discussion and debate with each other. And so I'd like to just call us back to whether there are any more questions for Mr. McAfee. If not, thank you very much for your testimony. Ellie Skelton, to be followed by Ann Bomstead Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Ellie Skelton. I'm the Executive Director of Wayside House, a substance abuse treatment program, a family reunification and supportive housing program in St. Louis Park in Minneapolis and Hennepin County. I'm also a member of MARCH, the Chemical Health Association Public Policy Committee, and a member of the United States Psychiatric Rehabilitation Association. There are a number of things that I found troubling in the governor's proposed budget, but I am going to limit my comment to just a few today. I think one of the problems with the budget is that some of the cuts we're going to make are going to cost increased costs throughout the entire system. We're not going to save any money. General assistance, the general assistance program is one of them. In our family reunification program, if a woman is going into substance abuse treatment and needs to get her kids back, wants to get her kids back, is working a program, has a disease, addiction, and is working to have that disease treated, if she's then on general assistance medical care because she's not eligible for MFIP when she doesn't have her kids. Kids and out-of-home placement cost a lot of money. If she no longer qualifies for general assistance, both health care and for the assistance program, the ability for her to reunify with her children is going to expand. It could even move into permanency. The costs that ripple through our system when we dismantle this system, I don't think we really realize how many places we're going to see if we cut that general assistance grant. The housing that people will lose because they can't afford. If you're in Section 8 housing, a lot of programs won't let you have zero rent. So if you lose your $203, right now they're paying $50 a month for rent. I don't think the governor has any idea of the ripple effect of dismantling general assistance medical care the cash assistance program will have on the system. We're going to see increased detox costs, increased child welfare costs, increased emergency room costs, and we're going to see families not reunified in Minnesota. The other piece I want to talk about is the cuts to the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. I realize we need a balanced approach. We are going to have cuts. And if we have a cut to the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, I would just like to recommend how you do that cut. Last year, the governor's unallotment plan reduced the rates to a maximum 160% of the average rate. Right now, we are going through a mandated redesign of the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund program because it's kind of a mess. It's county-driven rate system. Our rates in the system are anywhere from $13 a day to $200 a day. The state is going through a process right now to redesign those rates so that we have a state rate system. Last year, we made a cut. The governor's unallotment said, okay, here's the median rate. We're going to cut it at 160%. Anyone making over 160% is brought down. So those that are just barely making it at the very low rates can hold on until we redesign the system in 2011. Across the board, rate cut is not a fair way to do it when they're in the middle of this redesign. So if we need to make a cut to the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, I would ask that you look at that median rate. You know, I hate to even suggest a cut, but like 150%, because their rates will be coming down in 2011 anyway. Or 140% of median. We're going through a big redesign. It would just happen sooner. As far as a balanced approach, how do we solve this problem? What do we do? I've been an advocate for the alcohol excise tax or health impact fee to be increased for many years, and so has MARCH. Alcohol does not pay for, the tax does not pay for the cost to our society, the cost of detox, the cost of jail, DWI, missed work. We could easily raise alcohol 10 cents a drink, a dime a drink, and that would be, I believe, close to $800 million in revenue. That would be a true user fee. 20% of the alcohol in Minnesota is drank by 80% of the alcohol is drank by 20% of the individuals. In essence, they'd be prepaying for treatment. Those are individuals that are very hard in their addiction and drinking quite a bit. So thank you. I'll take your questions now.
Madam
Ms. Skelton, thank you very much for not only coming to testify but having suggestions for us.
I just want to also thank you for that too. It's we're looking for solutions. Mm-hmm. Believe me, this is hard on all of us, and we want to hear your testimony, but we want to hear if you have an idea, no matter what it is.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much, and thanks for the work you do. Ann Bomstead Miller, be followed by Al McAfee.
Madam Chair, if it's all right, I'll bring up the next two people on the list with me.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Bomstead Miller. I'm here on behalf of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition, which is a coalition that advocates that you can't provide quality care, quality long-term care, without quality jobs. We're here because we, too, have taken issue with several of the proposals in the governor's budget. And with me today are two people who know firsthand how the governor's proposed budget will impact long-term care, a service provider, as well as a consumer of long-term care services. So I'm going to turn it over to them to give our testimony.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Al McAfee, and I grew up during the Great Depression, and I served in the Navy in World War II, and I went to college on the GI Bill, and I became a high school business and economics teacher, and I worked 1 year in War Road, teaching 1 year in War Road, and 5 years in Leroy, southern part of the state, and 26 years in Roseville. I also had a locksmith's business, and I'm now retired. Alice, my wife of 61 years, worked as a legal secretary, then she worked as an accountant, then she worked as a federal program officer. After many years of retirement, my wife Alice developed dementia, and so I took care of it at home for about a year and a half, as long as I could, but we finally had to get her to a nursing home, and where she has lived there for 3 years. Over these past 3 years, I have gone up twice a day and helped her eat. And my son also helped the others and wheeled people around. My son and daughter would give me a break during the week, and I have taken a couple trips, but I prefer to be with Alice most of the time. Alice and I have served, and we have saved. At the nursing home, we are private payers. We have long-term care insurance, which pays for some of the cost. We use pensions, savings, and our Social Security to make up the difference. Can I make 3 points about the governor's proposed budget? One is the governor's proposal to repeal rate equalization is unfair and short-sighted. Asking Alice and I to pay more is unfair. It will drain our money faster and push her towards medical assistance. In the long run, this will drive up the state's cost. So if we want people to buy long-term care insurance, is this the right message? Second point I'd like to make is the 2.5 rate cut would likely cause staff cuts and worse care in our nursing homes and others across the state. And the third point is nursing homes may become less safe, more falls and unnecessary deaths may occur. As much as I love to be with Alice, I can't do it all alone. Please keep rate equalization in place and oppose the cuts to nursing homes. Thank you very much. Any questions?
I think we'll take the questions for the panel at the end.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Anderson. I've been a nursing assistant for 30 years. I'm here to say that it's very difficult to provide that service due to lack of funding, and this affects patient care and quality of life. When you don't fund us, where on earth do you think the cuts are made? They're certainly not going to feed someone bread and water. They're not going to cut out electricity or heat. So where does it come from? Staffing and wages. The average number of residents an aide takes care of and is responsible for is 11 to 16 residents. You have 2.5 hours to get them up, toileted, washed, dressed, vital signs taken, oral care made, bed made, soiled linens bagged up and disposed of, room tidied up, plus you squeeze in a bath, ambulations, repositioning, answering call lights, responding to safety alarms. You have less than 15 minutes per resident to do it. They are people who are sick, frail, and vulnerable. If you hurry, you're accused of being too rough. And if you don't hurry, you don't have enough time to get all your work done, so you get in trouble for that also. Just remember, you get what you pay for. And if you don't pay for quality of care, you're not going to get it. There will be more bed sores, more hip fractures, more infections, more neglect. It takes less than 2 hours to get a bed sore and over 2,000 hours to cure one. 15 to 20% of fractures result in death, and work-related injuries to staff and illnesses increase with a decrease of staffing levels. At the end of each day, I go to each of my residents and I thank them. I thank them for entrusting themselves into my care. I thank them for allowing me to be a part of their lives. I thank them for the day I spent with them, because in my heart, they are not a burden. It is not a burden, but a privilege to be a part of their lives. And I wish all of you would think of them the same way, for they have entrusted themselves into your care also, and that is a privilege. Please don't abuse that privilege, because imposing freezes, proposing cuts results in improper staffing, and that is neglect. And neglect, in my definition, is abuse. Thank you.
Thank you all. Are there questions? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you all for your testimony, everyone, for coming today to do their testimony. Senator, we're hearing such great stories today, a lot of statistics and information. I wonder, most people seem to be reading from a document. I wonder if it'd be possible for us to get copies or have them transmitted to your office.
Yeah, there's.
If anyone wants to do that, we'll make sure members of the committee get them. Other questions? If not, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the work you do. Teresa Carfell, to be followed by Dr. Gordon Alexander.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Teresa Carfell, and I serve as a chairperson of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. We are a group of 30 individuals representing a broad range of stakeholders throughout Minnesota. But today, I am speaking to you as an individual, a family member of a son who took his life as a result of his mental illness. When Craig came down with this mental illness, it was something I was totally unprepared for. I knew nothing about it. I got involved. I had learned firsthand what mental illness is like and how it affects others. The horrible situations he got into, the many times he was vulnerable and beaten and robbed and hopelessness, and the desperation that he felt and I felt. It was difficult for us to traverse the mental health system through all the red tape. When you see someone who was a college student at Notre Dame literally lose their mind, and you stand by helpless because of the lack of services or the difficulty in accessing those services, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. To see this absolutely beautiful person change before your eyes and you feel helpless to do anything. Craig took his life while still a patient in the hospital. He was admitted because he was suicidal. He asked to be taken to the hospital. We, as a family, thought he would be safe. The day before he died, the records show that he was still suicidal. The next day, the hospital was going to release him. Craig got up. He wasn't ready and wasn't stable and didn't want to be released. He wanted help. So that morning, he got up. He went to the reception desk, and he asked if he could go out for a smoke. In reality, he both had no matches and no cigarettes, and they let him out unescorted. And that is when he jumped from the hospital parking lot to his death. He was still a patient. There's the whole issue of basically releasing my son from the hospital before he was stable. It was a money issue. It was an insurance issue. a shortage of bed issue, a housing issue, community supports issue. Now, this happened several years ago. And since then, Minnesota has come a very long way. We now have access to in-home supports through ARMS and ACTS, medication, therapy, crisis services, supportive housing, and caddy waivers. These services would have helped my son live a stable life in the community. Cuts to these services, along with GAMC and general assistance, reduced rates to hospitals, and reduced eligibility for Minnesota care will only put more pressure on the hospitals and all systems of care. I do recognize that you have difficult choices to make. In making those choices, please consider people like Craig and the thousands of Minnesotans who felt they had no choice, basically no hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Dr. Gordon Alexander, to be followed by Linda Hamilton.
Good morning, Senator Berglund and committee members. I'm Gordy Alexander, obstetrician, now president of the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview. I thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective on the budget proposal. I'm here to make two comments and offer two suggestions of ideas to help. On behalf of Fairview Clinics, this is not a small issue that the governor's budget proposal raises. The total cost to us, we are an employer of over 20,000 individuals in Minnesota, is a $77 million impact over 3 years. And frankly, on top of several cuts in the last 10 years, this is getting harder and harder to manage and maintain our resources. The cuts to the medical assistant provider payments will further erode the entire healthcare system. This is not a surprise to you. You know this. 3% rate reduction alone is $11 million impact to Fairview. Fifth round of payment cuts in the last 10 years. These people aren't getting better. They're getting sicker all the time. We are paid less than it costs to deliver the care. And as you've heard from many safety net hospitals, this is unsustainable. So that's a problem. Cutting MRC funding is something that has not been mentioned. It's a short-sighted decision on the behalf of policymakers, I believe. Long-term consequences. No matter how we reform healthcare, and we do need to do that, we will need providers. And one of the provider groups is the physician world, and the MRC funding is necessary. It's very expensive to train our providers. We have 340 of them at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, and in 2010 alone, the cuts would provide an $8 million cut to supporting their training. Diminished residency programs will result in a diminished supply of physicians for all of us as we age. Now the suggestions. First of all, my hat's off to the Senate and House for approving the GAMC survival bill to allow time for making significant reform. I take my hats off to you for voting for it. Now we have a chance to override that, and I do believe that that should be important to get that done. So that's solution number one. Take advantage of opportunities that have been presented to you. Solution number two is that Health and Human Services is a large part of the state budget pie, and everyone needs to help. And we obviously are not saying we won't be a part of the solutions. However, there are parts of the budget that seemingly are immune to looking at. This is unconscionable. You can't educate people when they're sick. You can't educate them well when their whole family is sick. So to say we're not having an impact on education by not looking at K-12 education is unconscionable from my perspective. It seems to be playing well, but when you're talking about the kind of cuts that these people have talked about and not take on the entire budget doesn't seem right. So thank you for your time. Willing to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Senator, for taking the time to come today. Linda Hamilton, to be followed by Kevin Goodnow.
Madam Chair, member of the committee. My name is Linda Hamilton. I am the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association and RN at Minneapolis Children's Hospital. The MNA represents 20,000 registered nurses statewide. We are here today to speak in opposition to the governor's budget. We believe it is wrong for the governor to balance a budget on the backs of the state's poorest and neediest residents. We would like to thank you, Senator Berglund, and the committee for all your work and dedication in passing the GAMC. Bill, GAMC is a lifeline for so many of our patients. The governor's recent video is devastating. Under Governor Pawlenty's budget, people will die unnecessarily. We're going to decide whether you live or die based on whether you can afford to pay. That is not acceptable for anyone who has any belief in right and wrong. These budget cuts fly in the face of evidence that I see every day in the hospital where I work. From my 29 years of practicing nursing, I have learned the fundamental truth. The earlier we give care, the less that care work will cost and the more effective it is. With the governor's second veto of GAMC and now his budget proposal to eliminate health care for working adults on Minnesota Care, along with cuts to our mental health system and long-term care, nurses are deeply concerned about the dire consequences for our patients and the ability of all nurses to provide the care they need. At Children's, where I work, too often, instead of getting a prescription in the clinic, or if they actually get into the clinic, they cannot afford the prescribed antibiotic or inhaler. And then we're dealing with them in the hospital on ventilators, with IV meds, and truly a very, very sick child who may not leave the hospital the same child as when they came. All this because they lacked affordable health care. Nurses know more people wind up in the ICU with massive strokes because they can't afford meds for hypertension, or in the ED, or emergency room, because they cannot afford asthma medication. When we do not take care of the poorest among us, it hurts us all, and it costs us even more. Why would we do this? With deep cuts in our healthcare system, our hospitals are making significant changes to our RN staffing levels. At Hennepin County Medical Center, they have already cut staffing for RNs on the two largest inpatient units, medicine and surgery, trauma, and neuro. These changes will negatively impact our nurses' ability to provide quality, safe, and timely patient care that you and your family would expect from us there. These cuts also mean job losses. Again, at Hennepin County, an estimated 150 to 200 employees are expected to lose their job. This includes 40 RN FTE positions. This is a combination of hours reductions, restructuring, and total layoffs. This is the time when we are already working understaffed. As nurses, we know Governor Pawlenty's budget will only deepen the health care crisis. We believe the only responsible way to address this budget is through a balanced approach of both making sensible cuts and raising revenues. We once again ask for your leadership and to put forth a budget that allows us to care for Minnesotans who are poor and disadvantaged. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you for the work you do. Kevin Goodnow? Can you give us your name for the record?
Kevin is not here. I'm further on the list, so I'm just ready. Kevin Goodnow is not here.
And are you representing him?
No.
Oh, well, then you need to wait till I call on you. Is Dave Patterson here? Lynn Megan?
Senator Berglund, thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for my excitement to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am Lynn Megan. I am here today representing the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition and MNDACA, the Minnesota Developmental Achievement Association of Minnesota. We are provider associations representing day training and habilitation providers throughout Minnesota. Our members provide services to over 12,500 people who have disabilities, serving all 87 counties. Day training services provide employment supports, skill training, community involvement, therapies, transportation, and other individualized services to many of our Minnesota's most vulnerable citizens. I am employed as president at TSE Incorporated, a day training habilitation provider in Ramsey County. We provide training, support, and employment for 280 people in Ramsey County. I urge you to oppose the governor's proposed 2.5% rate cut for disability services providers for the following reasons. Another 2.5% on top of our 2.58% cut that we already received this biennium in July of 2009 would create significant challenges for our providers. The quality of our services is completely reliant on our strong competence and experience of our staff team. Without adequate compensation, providers are unable to recruit or retain qualified staff. Direct service staff members, on average in Minnesota, are paid less than $10 an hour. For that wage, people look for jobs with a lot less stress and personal responsibility. In the majority of our member organization, wages are frozen. I don't know of any provider that passed on the 2009 2.58 cut as a wage cut to and for our direct support professionals. How could we? Since 2003, day training organizations and other disability organizations have received cumulative rate increases of 4.9%, while inflation has grown 20.6%. In 2004, we had no rate increase. In 2003 and 2009, rates were cut by 1 and 2.5%, respectively. Now the governor is proposing cutting rates to our organizations by another 2.5% to help balance the budget. We cannot sustain that. As private nonprofits, day training organizations are well managed and serve a public purpose. We are businesses and are subject to all economic challenges faced by other private and government sectors. Our fixed costs continue to rise in areas like employee health insurance, fuel, utilities. At the same time, rates and private our private giving has declined. Some day training providers have already laid off employees, dropped health insurance and other benefits, and implemented non-paid furloughs. While working with fewer resources, day training habilitation providers must continue to operate under the same laws and rules created when the system was more adequately funded. Providers do not have the resources to give wage increases without any COLA adjustments, and certainly cannot give wage increases with provider rate cuts. Minnesotans with disabilities and the organizations that provide the supports for them have already borne more than our fair share to help balance the budget in previous years. Another rate cut brings the service system closer to a tipping point. In anticipation, we've heard that the Minnesota Department of Human Services is seeking a new staff position to monitor whether the state will be in compliance with federal regulations regarding access to disability services. The majority of our day training and habilitation services are financed by a combination of federal and state funds. For every state dollar cut, Minnesota loses access to federal funds. This is inconsistent with other efforts to maximize federal dollars and create jobs. If there is another rate cut of any amount in services for people with disabilities, we also risk losing those valuable federal match dollars. We do not, we need you to not support the governor's proposed budget cut of 2.58% or any amount of cut. Any cut in disability services funding is a tax increase to Minnesotans with disabilities, their families, and the people who provide services to them. The people we support depend on your leadership in assuring the service providers can depend on, that they can depend on to continue to meet their needs. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you for the work you do as well. Amy Nelson, to be followed by Ethan Roberts.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Amy Nelson, and I am the founder of Accurate Home Care and also a member of the Minnesota Home Care Association. I am here today to ask you to oppose the 2.5 rate cut for the home and community-based services. Our industry represents over 100,000 workers in the state. If you look at the Department of Economic Development website, the top three jobs in the state, regardless of where you are nurses, PCAs, and home health aides. If we continue to cut the wages with the reimbursement, this is not going to get any better. Our PCA companies are not the only thing that is home care. We represent lots of ICU level care provided in the home at five times less the cost that it is provided in the hospital or any other facility. I realize that part of the decreases were based off of all the fraud and abuse, and I recognize that. But in the last 5 years, PCA companies have tripled in the number of providers that there are out there. The Class A home care providers out there have increased 227 in the last 2 years. We seem to be handing these licenses and provider numbers out like they're candy and not looking at the quality of what we're really doing. The possible solutions that I feel are very probable is let's get outcomes-based for home care services, not that are Medicare, because there are Medicare outcomes, but all of the rest of us, there's only 220 Medicare providers, and there's over 1,000 home care providers. So what are these other 800 providers being measured on? They're not. We also need to incentivize the quality providers that are out there and recognize that they are providing the service where people want to be at quality and cost-effective services. And we also need to limit the number of providers that we're giving out these licenses because it is not helping the industry. Home care is the future. It's cost-effective, and it's where people want to be. And it promotes health care reform if it's a sustainable business and a respected line of work. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks for the work you do. Ethan Roberts, to be followed by Kim DeFranco.
Good morning. My name is Ethan Roberts. And I'm the director of the Twin Cities Jewish Community Government Affairs Program at the JCRC. In my capacity as government affairs director, I represent the Jewish Social Service Agency of the Twin Cities. These nonprofits, which provide a continuum of services from early childhood education to hospice, job training to medical translation, rely upon a combination of private philanthropy, which I might add is certainly diminishing in this time, as well as over $20 million in annual federal, state, and local funding to serve thousands of vulnerable Jewish and non-Jewish Minnesotans each year. In total, the agencies I represent this morning employ well over 1,000 Minnesotans from all backgrounds and include some of our state's largest and oldest nonprofits, including two which are over 100 years old. While there are many aspects of Governor Pawlenty's proposed human services budget that deeply concern us, time constraints allow me only to address the governor's proposed 2.5% medical assistance cut to long-term care providers, which is a $37 million statewide reduction. As you've already heard this morning, I think a lot of excellent testimony about what this impact will have on clients and their families. I would add that it cuts both, obviously, nursing homes and elderly waiver programs such as Meals on Wheels, which are, I think, the reform that we often speak about and saving considerable amounts of taxpayer dollars by enabling seniors to live independently. But what I really want to discuss is not just the harm on the individuals, but what this impact will have on Minnesota's overall economy. The long-term care imperative estimates that the cuts to older adult services will result in over 500 lost jobs in Minnesota. Within just the agencies I represent, we're looking at an annual loss of $350,000 and a layoff of 20 employees. Now, each of these employees who are soon to be laid off, or if they're fortunate, merely have their wages and benefits cut, are as much a part of the Minnesota economy as anyone else, like all of us.
They pay taxes. They shop at our state's businesses. Tightening Minnesota's proverbial belt by laying off his dedicated employees who care for our parents and grandparents when we as family members can no longer do it all on our own will do absolutely nothing to improve Minnesota's high unemployment rate. In fact, it will only make it worse. Now, I realize decisions that confront this committee, the legislature and the governor are not easy, so I've come with solutions. Despite the challenge of this $1.2 billion deficit, you have choices. So, for example, you can choose to shelter 40% of the state's budget, which is K-12 education, at the expense of the elderly, the sick, and the poor, or you can do what I know the Senate did last session, is take a more balanced approach and spread the pain throughout all state-funded services. Similarly, you can choose to address the budget deficit with cuts in one-time funds and shifts, or you can choose to address this budget deficit with cuts, which will be painful, as well as sustainable new sources of revenue, which will allow us to retain the very infrastructure that makes Minnesota an exceptional place to grow up, raise a family, and retire with dignity. And because I represent a 501c3, I know I've been kind of bashing the governor's budget, but I have what I'm sure will not come across as good news or not welcome words for the chair and many members of this committee. I do think it's a time to readdress the rate equalization law as well. A sinking ship will drown all passengers, medical assistance patients and private pay alike. Our nurses do not know who are medical assistance patients. They do not care who are the private pay patients. If we absorb a government cut for MA and a corresponding cut for private pay, it's just less revenue for everyone, and everyone will suffer. And I can assure you that if this rate equalization law is repealed, we will continue to provide the same excellent quality of care for everyone. We're absolutely committed to it. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you as always for soliciting our testimony and listening to us. I know it's a lot to listen to, and it's greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Mr. Roberts, I just have a couple of comments in regard to your testimony. The first is that, you know, the governor really hasn't offered a complete budget.
I completely agree because of the FMAP. Is that what you're referring to, Madam Chair?
Right.
Yeah, I agree. That's very problematic.
So he's counting on the FMAP money to come in order not to have to cut K-12 education.
I know. I've spent a lot of time talking to members of our Congress, members of the House. Last week I spoke to Senator Klobuchar, Congressman Walz, Congressman Ellison, Congresswoman McCollum, all personally, and I all urge them to work as hard on FMAP as I can. I also note that there's a letter circulating among the governors that I think 43 governors have signed. Unfortunately, Governor Plenty has not signed that letter. So I don't really have much leverage with the governor, but if anyone does in this room, I would encourage you to urge the governor to fight as hard as he can to see that this FMAP happens, because you're absolutely right, Madam Chair. If we do not get that money, it's going to be cuts to education, and it's going to be probably deeper cuts to human services.
And so it would be a little bit like if I were to be proposing that we save general assistance by early enrollment into Medicaid, something that's been proposed by Congress but hasn't been passed, and we don't know if it will pass. The second thing I'd like to say is that in regard to the rate equalization law, while your nurses may not know who's on medical assistance and who's not, it is true that in other states, we have Medicaid nursing homes and we have non-Medicaid nursing homes because they do not have a rate equalization law. And I cannot really believe that it won't be very long, maybe not in your facility, but in other facilities where people will no longer be accepted once they rely on public assistance for their nursing home care. And I find it hard to believe that the Twin Cities Jewish community would like to see that happen.
Madam Chair, I would only respond that 60% of our residents are medical assistance eligible. We're committed to everyone. The rates that we receive are not sufficient. The monies we receive from private pay are not sufficient. We raise money, you know, through grants and through fundraising to make sure that everyone can have excellent care. The reason why my position exists is to serve the poor people within our community. we are absolutely committed to everyone so that everyone can live in dignity. So you're right, I cannot speak outside of our community, but I've spoken with our executives, including people who do know, you know, who is and who isn't. Everyone will have the same excellent room. I encourage you to come to our new campus in St. Paul, where we have a HUD independent living building. It's just as nice as the private pay market rate building.
Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Roberts, I very much sympathize with the position you're in when you're facing the possibility of a 2.5% rate cut. And there are many nursing homes in our state that have nowhere to cut. I mean, they've already had to go out of business because they were having to operate at a loss. And so, you know, the margins are so thin that 2.5% will put a number of additional nursing homes out of business. The problem, as I see it, is it right when your back is in a corner and you're trying to come up with a solution to pick a bad solution because you have no other choice? That's almost like, you know, and it's not a good long-term solution, as has already been expressed, I think, by one of the other testifiers. What ends up happening is people just lose their assets sooner, and they end up back on a government program, and now we've acquiesced to a bad long-term solution that in the long run isn't going to benefit people in nursing homes or ultimately our overall health care costs because we've just kind of shifted around the payment. And in the bigger picture, you asked us not to do that. But when it comes right down to your area of responsibility, you're seeing the devastation that's happening in nursing homes, and you're really concerned about that, but you're philosophically kind of asking us to do the same thing for you that you're asking us not to do in the bigger picture from my perspective. So I sympathize very much with the situation you're in, but I don't think we should adopt bad policy because we've been forced to have our backs up against the wall by our governor.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'll call on Kim DeFranco, Virginia Weldon, and Deb Konichke. I think they can all come up together.
My name is Kim DeFranco. I work with, I'm a member of the Welfare Rights Committee, and thank you for having us here today and testifying on the governor's budget. Just want to say that we believe no cuts to human services, not one dime, not one penny should ever happen. We know that we're still in this economic crisis. This economic crisis isn't over, and for many of us, we've been in an economic crisis way before it started. We hear stories every day from people that are struggling, losing jobs, losing the small income that they have, and they have nowhere to go, and things are just getting worse. Pawlenty's cuts to the poor and working people are immoral, not logical. They're short-sighted and just plain wrong. What's troubling most about his cuts are the cuts to MFIP, cuts to the SSI, to SSI with families that are actually receiving MFIP, and also the refinancing of the TANF funds. Now, during this economic crisis that's still going on, Pawlenty wants to cut from the most vulnerable, the children and family and single people, from the sick and the elderly. We say it's not time to cut any programs that help poor and working families, families with disabilities, or single people. Many programs are the only safety net for poor families and single people have. Now these programs, now for the new families that are actually falling below the poverty line or losing their jobs, these are the only programs that are their new safety net. I'd like to talk about solutions. For many years, we've come to the Capitol and talked about closing the tax corporate loopholes, and the rich people from Minnesota. Many years they've been finding ways to not pay their fair share of taxes, even though they're from Minnesota. We bring this every year, and every year it never really passes. Some say it's not enough money to actually balance the budget, but you know, every penny counts. And after all, those corporations and people that have made money from our labor, but now that we're losing our jobs, we're not able to suffer anymore. So now it's time for them to help out their fellow Minnesotans in our time of need. Another solution that I haven't really heard of, but I get to experience also, is wage cuts. I say you should take a look at your salaries and cut them like 10% like most of the workforce that have experienced it. You should give up your health care plan, give up your per diem, take furlough days. After all, the majority of the workforce have experienced most, if not all of these. Take all that money that's saved by doing these types of cuts and put it towards the programs that really will benefit the poor and working Minnesota, the poor and working people of Minnesota. Take that money, apply it to the GMAC cuts, to the GA cuts, to SSI, to housing, and the special food programs. That's it. So, I mean, you have a chance now to actually stand up and fight against these cuts. I mean, we've been suffering for so long, and it's time not to attack the people that really need the help now. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Virginia Weldon, and I am with the Welfare Rights Committee. I am a recipient of GA. Unfortunately, I have to be on such a small amount per month, which is 203. If I didn't get Section 8, I wouldn't have a place to live in. I would be probably homeless, staying with whoever and whenever and wherever. And also, my medical condition is a medical condition that reoccurs frequently. I go to a physician, a clinic at United Hospital Pain Center, and I get injections every 3 to 4 months to alleviate the pain that I have. I have nerve damage, and I also get injections in my muscles because I have laceration in my muscles as well. So when I had better days and stuff like that, and you know, I would go job hunting, and I don't care how many applications I put over like 200 to maybe plus over 200, and I never got a job. Never. Even though I was qualified and most of the positions I applied for, I was overqualified, and I even had applied for like part-time cashiering and stuff because I know that I'm limited in lifting so much weight per day. So I've had three interviews, and it makes you mad when you go into a place and you have, you know, they show you how their companies ran, and then yet they don't call you back or anything. But it's like, well, why would you show me, why would you take me in the back and show me how your companies ran and what position this is in your production area and then not call me back at all? You know, don't send me a letter or anything. So, okay, after, you know, and this is all the situation that I've been going through from February of 1999. I have been applying frequently for SSDI, and I'm, you know, like I said, if it wasn't for me being on Section 8, that the $203 I do get from general assistance would, I mean, that's a small amount considering that I have all these medical conditions, and I also have to buy over-the-counter medicine to, you know, help alleviate some of the conditions I have when it does hit me, and when it does, it hits pretty hard. So I've been in and out of emergency rooms, and since November of 2007, I've been going through surgery procedures. On April 1st, I would go through another surgery procedure, and that is to have my nerve burnt in my inside of my spine because that's where most of the damage is. And having, you know, the injections was bad enough, you know, because when they go into your spine, it's really painful. And there's nothing you can do about it but just clutch the pillow or whatever. So, I mean, this happened all before the economic crisis. I just hope and pray that, you know, we have the opportunity to stop Plenty from cutting the GA, cutting the GAMC or medical assistance, and I just hope and pray that you guys can stop them cuts. And thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you. My name is Deb Konichny, and I am here representing the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout, which is a coalition of low-income community, labor, immigrant rights, peace and justice, and student organizations in Minnesota. We're, as we all know, we are experiencing the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression, and tens of thousands of us are losing jobs, facing layoffs, running out of unemployment, facing loss of housing. It is poor and working people who are suffering the most from this economic crisis. As usual, it is the wealthy who are affected the least and even profit during our greatest time of economic stress. Yet, it is those of us who are suffering the most from the crisis that Governor Pawlenty has said must pay for the budget deficit. This newest budget proposal is one more in a long line of sick, disastrous proposals by Governor Pawlenty. It is an attack on the poor. It is an attack on working people. It is an attack on people with disabilities. It's an attack on women, an attack on mothers, an attack on children. When does this madness stop? Pawlenty's budget proposes to eliminate general assistance for over 20,000 Minnesotans. GA pays, as you heard, a measly $203 a month to individuals who are disabled and extremely poor and unable to work. Pawlenty also proposes to cut survival income from children and their caregivers who are both poor and have disabilities. His proposal would cut hundreds of dollars every month out of the welfare grant for families on MFIP who have a disabled family member that is receiving SSI. The fact is that a family of three, including one who has a disability, gets only $437 a month in the MFIP welfare grant for the other two family members. Under Pawlenty's proposal, it would essentially wipe out the entire $437 for the welfare grant, forcing the entire family to live on the nominal SSI check belonging to the family member with a disability. A cut such as this has never been carried out in any other state in the country. It basically forces parents to break federal law by using the federal SSI grant for living expenses for the entire family rather than for the needs of the family member with the disability as intended. Many families are forced to go on welfare because the caregiver or child has a disability and they are therefore unable to work. These are cruel, inhumane cuts that punish individuals and families in poverty and people with disabilities. Pawlenty also proposes to eliminate a state program for food for legal non-citizens in poverty. And again, he proposes to steal tens of millions of dollars from the federal TANF dollars that the state receives to provide public assistance for parents and their children in poverty, and then he uses that money to supplant state spending. Pawlenty's proposal would also cut tens of thousands of low-income working Minnesotans off of Minnesota Care health care. Meanwhile, the richest in this state continue to be untouched. Every budget deficit has been balanced on the backs of poor and working people of Minnesota, while the wealthiest have not paid even one dime. In fact, they've amassed greater wealth, more wealth, at our expense. Permanent tax breaks over the past number of years going to the rich have made them richer and have cost the state billions in revenue. The poor, disabled, and working people of this state are paying with our blood, while the wealthy are swimming in their profits. It is long past the time to stop this madness. Every single legislator in this capital has constituents who are being hit by the economic crisis, no matter which party you're from. As more of us fall into unemployment or run out of benefits, the more we are in need of these very programs. Politicians should be expanding the programs to help Minnesotans in a time of economic downturn instead of cutting them. Politicians should make those with the ability to pay for the deficit. We have the solution for the budget deficit. It's not to share the pain across which program to cut, or who should we cut education, should we cut health and human services. The solution to the budget deficit is to tax the rich. Make them pay for all the tax breaks, tax loopholes, all the money and riches they have gained and enjoyed over the past number of years. This is our solution and our suggestion. Do not follow the so-called leader. It is clear we have a governor who is willing to sacrifice the good people of this state for his own political gains. It is clear the governor is leading the charge in a war against poor and working Minnesotans, and he does not care how many casualties there are. Really, there needs to be a mutiny over here at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. Plenty is sinking Minnesota, and as the so-called captain of the ship, he is not planning to go down with it. He is planning to jump ship and let the rest of us perish. So you, as elected representatives of the people of this state, do not have to go along with this. In fact, you have the responsibility in your position of power to resist this path of destruction. It is time to say enough is enough. Reject these criminal cuts and make the rich pay. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Deb, I have a question for you before you leave the table. So last session we tried to pass a tax increase. I think you're familiar with the components of it, and it was vetoed by the governor, and we failed to be able to override his veto. So if that were to happen again this year, do you think it would be better for this committee to try to put together as good of a budget, to balance the budget as we can, or to go home without a balanced budget, knowing the governor will pick and choose his unallotments himself?
I think it is important to stand on the side of morality and on the side of justice. And I think to buy into cutting when there is obviously a whole population in this state who have not paid a dime, not even close to their fair share, is what everyone from both parties should be doing. This governor is taking us down a disastrous path, and we are saying, do not go along with it.
But he has the power to take us there anyway, is my point.
Well, I think it needs to be, people need to be looked at from both parties to look at their constituents that are suffering, because everybody has them in their districts. And I think people need to decide which side you're going to stand on, the side of a governor that's taking us down or the side of the people you represent.
Questions, Senator Coring?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question, the Welfare Rights Committee. What is the Welfare Rights Committee? Is it a nonprofit? How do you become a member of it? I am trying to get a grasp on who these people are.
The Welfare Rights Committee is made up of people who are on public assistance, current or former. People are working, because if you're working poor, because most jobs that people get who are receiving public assistance or trying to get out of poverty. In our experience and working with the community members, they don't get the high-paying jobs. So if you are a current member on public assistance or a former member receiving Social Security or any public assistance, if you consider yourself working poor, and if you agree that there should be no cuts to human services, then you could be a part of the committee. But I also want to say that people work. Some people apply many years. I mean, Virginia has been in this committee before and bringing her boxes of applications that were rejected. And you know, people on public assistance and who are poor below the poverty line, mainly single women with children for many different reasons, are the last to be hired and the first to be fired. So even if you have a good job, you are most likely one paycheck away from being where we are, or where most people are. I mean, you know this. Everyone, like Deb was saying, everybody in the state of Minnesota knows somebody who's poor on assistance, whatever assistance it is. Even if you're receiving food stamps, people will demonize you for being on public assistance. Mm-hmm. And people now are angry. People have been working their entire lives, no matter how long they've been working. We've been around 17 years. People are angry. They think the government should help them out. And when they see government bail out the banks and the corporations, refuse to even fight for closing tax corporate loopholes, they're angry because they believe I'm working, I should get some help. And we all contribute to society. And a part of demonizing anyone who's on public assistance or losing their job is just plain wrong. And that's what Palenty is doing. So you should understand, people are very angry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Coring, I'm going to suggest...
I just have a couple minutes,
yeah,
please?
Yeah, but I'm just going to suggest that if you want, you go to one of their meetings. They have a large membership, and then you could meet the people that belong to their group.
Yeah. Well, go down to the welfare office and leaflet with us.
All right. Mr. DeFranco, you said that that people should take a furlough or take less wages. You were saying that in your testimony. I will tell you that in Brainerd, in Brainerd proper, there's 20% unemployment. And the 80% of the people that are working less hours. Mm-hmm. They've taken a furlough. They've taken less wages. And so if we're going to tax them more, it just puts more pressure on them. And then the notion that we're going to tax the rich. Mm-hmm. I've got a friend of mine who owns a painting company. He had 20 employees. You might consider him rich. You might. Because the economy, he had to lay 10 people off. So now he's probably still rich. So let's tax him some more. And you know what he's going to do then? He's going to lay more people off. And that isn't going to help. So
why couldn't he just?
And I will say that Governor Palenty's budget is a proposed budget. This legislature makes a decision too. And so we'll weigh in and we'll come up with our own plan.
Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, just with regard to that, I would just like to say, and I've known Senator Coring for a long time, so I'm going to take him at his word that he means what he says and his heart's in the right place. I hope as we go through this and consider this and look for ways to, for example, gain additional money from the federal government that we just threw away because our governor told us if we did what he asked us to do, we could save GMC. And then when we did it and threw away that federal money, he vetoed the bill anyway. I hope that people like Senator Coring will not just follow the leader and will make independent decisions about what's in the best fiscal and overall, you know, general welfare of our state. Because no one has proposed raising taxes on those people who have lost their jobs or are in the lower middle income groups, I don't believe. And in terms of who can sharing the pain, I think what we've heard is just saying some of these tax breaks that we've put in place in recent years when we could afford them for people who are wealthy, maybe we can't afford them as much now. Everyone else is having to pay more through property taxes, additional fees, additional contributions through their health care programs, everything else. And that should just be spread around somehow more fairly.
Okay, we have to move on now in order to get through our agenda.
Senator
Berglund,
may I just ask Ms. DeFranco one quick question here?
Maybe you want to do it on the side. If you want to do it on the side, I'm worried we're not going to get through everybody. And there are some people that took time off from work to come. So Jean Bailey, to be followed by Ann Henry.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeannie Bailey, a former nurse, and I'm the CEO of United Family Medicine in St. Paul. United Family Medicine is a community health center located just down the street on West 7th, and we provide primary medical care to patients, irregardless of their ability to pay. In essence, we're part of a wide-ranging healthcare safety net together with 16 other community clinics throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the privilege of sharing a perspective on community health centers. To give you some perspective, United Family Medicine serves over 12,000 patients annually. Last year, 26% of our 3,600 new patients walked in the door and were uninsured when they first came to the clinic. Consequently, we aggressively seek to enroll eligible uninsured patients into public programs, such as Minnesota Care, with the help of our patient advocacy services, and are successful in doing that about 50% of the time. With higher premiums and proposed lowered eligibility, this may not always be the case in the future. That means over 1,500 uninsured patients did not qualify for any kind of government program, and this number will increase. These patients did receive care, however, many paying the minimum $20 per cost of an entire visit. An additional 31% of our patients are enrolled in Medical Assistance, Minnesota Care, or GAMC. We serve the highest number of seniors through Medicare of community health centers, and these other 15 community health centers, our sister clinics, we call them, throughout Minnesota, provide valuable primary care access. We're also the training site for new family doctors. We're talking about family doctors all the time. Over 80 new family doctors have graduated, and they serve across Minnesota in towns and cities such as Grand Rapids, Little Falls, my hometown, New Ulm, Winona, Woodbury, and West St. Paul. I'm here today to testify on three items in the government supplemental budget proposal. First, I'm opposed to the governor's proposal to reduce by $1 million the grant that federally qualified health centers get in Minnesota. At United Family, we use these funds to focus on cancer screening for individuals who are uninsured, provide access to dental care, and now we provide diabetic education. If these funds were cut, our health center would have to consider curtailing these and other uncompensated services. You have received, I believe, a letter from Jonathan Watson that will help explain some of the detail in the federal stimulus funding, because there's a lot of questions about that in the governor's budget. But I will just briefly state, on a side note, the governor's budget proposal justifies the cut by assuming that community health centers received $4.8 million from the federal stimulus package. The number's correct. It's more than $1 million less for that, but it was for a three-month period that ends in September 2010. Collectively, community health centers provide $33 million in care to the uninsured, of which $18 million is covered by the federal government, including one-time stimulus funds. That does leave a gap of $10 million across the state. A loss of $1 million in this budget reduction would significantly impact our ability to care for the uninsured. You also know, I was just so surprised, in 2009, the state of Minnesota Public Health Department quantified the number of uninsured individuals up by 100,000 now to 480,000. This is the highest number since the state began keeping records in 1990. So we know that we will be able to serve more uninsured, and that's our privilege, that's our commitment. The second piece of the governor's budget we're opposed to is reducing Minnesota Care eligibility for single adults without children to 75% of poverty. Scaling back this eligibility for Minnesota Care will simply translate to additional uninsured at all the community health centers. The downturn in the economy has taught us how far uninsured will travel for primary care. At our clinics, our physicians are also on the Mayo model of payment. It's a salary, so it's not based on how many patients, how many procedures you do. The 16 community health centers in Minnesota serve over 50% of the state zip codes and 100% of the zip codes in Ramsey County. Finally, we'd like to state our opposition to the governor's plan to transition GMC enrollees into Minnesota Care. We're concerned about the premiums and their ability to pay the premiums if they don't have the funding. We serve many GMC patients. They're frail. Their conditions can be managed. They will be seen in a much more expensive emergency room setting. And the governor's proposed plan sets off a cycle of increasing costs, not decreasing them. So we are afraid that the governor's budget proposal dramatically creates more uninsured Minnesotans. So I want to thank you for your time today, but we do have three small suggestions. The first is, let us know how we can help you. The community health centers have an unusual governance structure. Every single community health center is governed by a patient-run board. So 51% of the persons who govern me, govern our clinic, are patients and users of the center. So let us know. We can activate those folks, and they're very committed individuals and understand the value of community health centers. I would hope that there's ways we could leverage, and the state legislature could leverage the federal government to provide more community health centers in Minnesota, so 100% of zip codes are covered. For those, there is data that supports persons who go to a community health center, an MA patient, the cost of care is at least $1,000 less as opposed to going to a random clinic, because we pride ourselves on trying to establish medical homes. And then we also support the fact that all elements of the budget should be reviewed, and processes for improving government and cutting costs are important. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Yes, Ms. Bailey. My understanding of the proposal that the governor made in regard to the community clinic grants, and I might be wrong, but my understanding of it was a shift. So they would delay the payment by one quarter. And I guess my question to you is, could you, because it would, you would still get the money within your same fiscal year, could you sustain that kind of a proposition?
I think our community health centers would be willing, absolutely, to look at how we could sustain a shift. It's the reduction that we're concerned about, the elimination of it, because we know that the number of uninsured will increase.
Well, I understood your testimony. I just wanted to ask you about this aspect of it. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for the work you do. Ann Henry. To be followed by Carrie Thurlow and Toby Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society in Minneapolis. In the brief time today, I'd like to make four overall points and then mention a few specific items in the governor's budget. First, as I was preparing for today, it really became apparent that I might as well give you a list of practically every item in the governor's budget in Health and Human Services in terms of the direct or indirect impact on people with disabilities. Let me just give you an example. It is extremely important that we avoid total and permanent disability, that we prevent what we can. And all of the cuts that you've been hearing about and discussing in terms of general assistance, medical care, Minnesota Care for Working Adults, cash GA assistance, critical access dental, and those important mental health services, which provide help to people to stay as functional as possible and out of the deeper end services, are crucially important for people with disabilities, because we really, really need to prevent what we can. Second point has already been made by several speakers today, and that is that these cuts are on top of a parade of cuts in disability services and other health care, certainly, going back to 2002. And the impact is already having significant effects. Third, I want to thank you and encourage you to continue your questioning of the department and governor spokespeople about the consequences on these budget pages. For instance, my clients with disabilities' needs are not going to disappear because we eliminate adult PT, OT, and speech. Those needs are going to come out in other places. And it's very clear that the governor's budget is nothing short of irresponsible in failing to recognize the moving parts of what's been called human hydraulics. We are pushing down with a lot of pressure on people, and they are going to come out in many, many ways, certainly individually, but we're going to have emergencies and crises, and really, I think, erosions of families and our long-term service infrastructure that will take a long time to rebuild and will be much, much more expensive. Fourth, we understand the long-term fiscal picture is very grim. We strongly support a balanced approach, tax increases. We understand there will have to be spending cuts. We really urge reform and administrative simplification. I will provide my comments in writing and have more specifics, but in terms of reforms, we've been working to improve consumer-directed supports. It saves money, it improves quality, and lets people make choices on what, within a limited budget, will make the most difference for them. I think we can make more progress there. Second, we've been working to simplify the county management of disability services. We're doing it times 87 or maybe 84 if you count the one group of counties that work together. We really cannot afford to do that anymore. And the third item I just want to highlight is last session we discussed a public equity housing fund. We provide a lot of public money for housing of people with disabilities, seniors, and vulnerable folks. When that property is sold, we do not capture the public investment. And we think it is long overdue that we do that. We know it'll change the business model for residential providers. This idea was first surfaced when Maria Gomez was the Commissioner of Human Services many, many years ago. I wish we had done it then. But those are just a few of the ideas. Now let me just mention a couple of the cuts. The MFIP SSI cut on these budget pages has to be one of the cruelest. These families are already living in poverty, dealing with disability, and to take this money away from them is a very, very serious problem and will have, we think, very serious effects if done. We do agree that there are some very serious concerns legally, and we will be providing information about that. The adult rehab elimination, PTOT and speech, that's going to be a classic example of the workings of human hydraulics. Very quickly, people are going to be staying in hospitals or nursing facilities longer because they need to get physical therapy so they can function better or one of the other therapies. It's a really ill-advised cut. And my list will go on and on, but I know my time does not. So I want to thank you, and thank you for your service.
We'll look forward to your written comments as well. Thank you. Thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
I'll try to make this really quick because I know our time is limited, but you talked about reform, and I'm really interested in suggestions from within systems that, you know, where people understand the details of this more than I do, about how we can try to reduce some of the expenses, say, between the state and county, within counties, within programs, and do it quickly. Because we really haven't seen, from my perspective, any leadership from the executive side on where we can cut costs for within government itself. The cuts always seem to come to the pass-through money that really impact mm-hmm. services and individual family budgets. I've introduced a bill in natural resources to try to put that process in place, but I've heard that in human services there's a lot we could do similar to that. So I'd be really interested in hearing back from anyone who has any concrete suggestions about how we could quickly, at a low cost, try to streamline some of that service delivery.
All right. We will be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, while we have our next two people come forward, I'd like to just ask anyone else on the agenda who would be able to come back on Thursday, if you could please send a note up to the table, and we will be taking testimony on Thursday as well. And that way maybe we can accommodate the people who can't come back. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I am here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. If it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I'll be joined by Mr. Pearson, also with the Long-Term Care Imperative.
Yes.
And we'll be tag-teaming.
Yeah, I did call you both up.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. First, it's no surprise that we oppose the governor's proposed cuts to older adult services. I think the reason we oppose the cuts is because of the adverse economic impact the cuts will have in many of your communities. Investments in long-term care strengthen our economy while protecting our seniors. Long-term care supports 112,600 jobs in the state of Minnesota. Long-term care is responsible for a total of $6.7 billion worth of contribution to the state of Minnesota, in direct and indirect. The materials that are being passed out will illustrate this as well. In short, we oppose the cuts because in many communities, older adult service providers are a vital economic engine and one of the largest employers in rural Minnesota communities.
So today we'd like to focus on two specific areas. I'll focus on the cuts to home and community-based services, and then I'll turn it back over to Mr. Pearson to talk about the impacts on care centers. But before we talk specifically about the governor's budget as it relates to home and community-based services, we do want to kind of put a little framework here and say that the transition to home and community-based services here in Minnesota has, we believe, been a significant reform in the way we deliver long-term care to our seniors. Minnesota is leading in this transition, and in fact, now we are serving more seniors in home and community-based settings than we are in care centers. And the long-term care imperative believes that this is a very good thing. The reason why we've made this transition, there's probably two very important factors. The first is it's what seniors want. Our vision, the imperative's vision, is that we provide options to seniors so that they can receive their long-term care needs met in a place that they call home. And that means having a very vibrant set of access to a vibrant set of options in every Minnesota community for home and community-based services. But the second reason, and probably relevant to this discussion today, is that home and community-based services are cost-effective. One of the handouts that you'll be receiving indicates that serving seniors through the elderly waiver program, kind of the major waiver program that we're here today about, costs nearly $2,600 less than if that senior were to receive care in a care center. And so, again, as we talk about the impacts to the budget, this is a very cost-effective way of providing needs for seniors. When the cuts are put through to this program, many times seniors are left to turn to care centers to receive their care. For the record, the long-term care imperative opposes the governor's proposal to cut elderly waiver rates by an additional 2.5%. In part, it's a piling on. In 2009, rates were reduced by 2.58%, the governor's proposal would be an additional cut to that. In addition, the handout that you received illuminates several other administrative actions that have negatively impacted providers' rates in this area. The cuts to elderly waiver fall largely, and you've heard testimony, I'll certainly amplify it again, will fall most significantly on the backs of caregivers and seniors, and will limit our ability to meet the needs of seniors in these settings. With that, I'll just say that as Minnesota's changing demographics continue to age, meaning that we'll soon have more seniors than school children, we want to make sure that seniors have the ability to access home and community-based services, and so we ask that you look very carefully at the governor's proposal in this area.
And from a skilled nursing facility perspective, it's important to remember that 76 cents out of every dollar goes directly to wages and benefits. So we've been asked repeatedly, so what will happen if these cuts go through? In the past, we've done a survey regarding how people responded to a 0% rate increase or revenue decreases. And the top respondents were included freezing staff wages, reducing health care benefits, eliminating or reducing step or merit increases, reducing staff hours, and staff layoffs. These cuts will directly impact our staff, which directly impact the workers, which will have adverse effects on the economy in your local communities. Other things that have resulted from the lack of economic investment have included nursing facility closures. As was previously referenced, there have been numerous closures. Since 2000, we've had 56 nursing facilities close. 34% of Minnesota counties have experienced at least one closure, and 54% of the closures occurred in the seven-county metro area. So cuts to older adult services will harm the economy in many rural Minnesota communities. Cuts by themselves are not the solution.
We'd like to also close by, I know many have challenged us to talk about reforms or things that we could do to improve the situation. I do want to point out that the Long-Term Care Imperative released a document earlier this session called Changes Imperative. In that document, we lay out a multi-prong approach of things that we should be doing to address many of the challenges we face in this area of the budget. We know that because of the demographic challenges, the budget is constantly strained. And so we've called for a multi-prong approach that is a combination of increased public investment, also increasing the role of personal responsibility, encouraging people to plan for and save for their own long-term care needs, and then also an administrative alignment or refocusing, bringing together core functions of the government to talk about, really plan for and create a plan for senior services. Part of that plan has been embodied in the governor's budget. We do want to express our support for the repeal of rate equalization. We know that that's been called for before. That is illuminated in part of our plan calling for personal responsibility. We think that that's not a complete solution, and certainly we have many concerns about the governor's budget and certainly would like to have a further discussion about it, but we do want to lend our support for that particular proposal. And in closing, we welcome the discussion throughout the session about the governor's proposal and any ideas that also may come to the table as the session goes on.
Are there any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Based on your projections, if we were to remove rate equalization, how much, either in terms of a percentage or in terms of dollars, of an increase is there, would there be for private pay patients?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we are continuing to look and try to forecast that particular issue. It's important to note that the last time this particular issue was fiscal noted was many years ago, and the ways that we've used care centers today are much different. There are shorter stays. There are certainly other products on the market that assist people in paying for long-term care. And certainly, we want to be able to understand that. But it is also clear that right now it's widely acknowledged that there's a gap between the reimbursement rate and the cost of care. And currently, MA rate as well as private pay rate is about $20 per resident per day less than it costs facilities to care meet their needs.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'm just assuming based on that, that at a minimum at least, and I don't know if you're proposing putting any limits in what the increase could be in your bill. I don't think there is at the present time. But it sounds to me like we're talking about at least a $600 per month increase in what someone in a private pay situation would pay. And I can only say that, and perhaps more, because what happens on the hospital side is that we charge even more in the private sector to make up for losses elsewhere. And all this cost shifting that gets used to justify the higher prices that we pay for aspirin and everything else, well, I understand the dilemma that you're facing, just overall escalates the cost of delivering care. And so I guess I would challenge to say that this is about personal responsibility. I believe that people already, the cost of long-term care is expensive, and people like to avoid it as much as possible, having to lose their assets, go on Medicaid, have lien on their estates, and so forth. And so to the extent that people can, I think they try to take responsibility because it's expensive to go into a nursing home. It's not like it doesn't cost anything if you're in a private pay situation. It costs a lot. And so escalating that cost at a time when people can least afford it, I just don't think that's the right solution.
I'm gonna cut this off at this point in time. I just think it's clear that you disagree with Senator Olson. Any other questions? And let's call on Bruce Nelson to be followed by Alan Ingram.
Madam Chair, members of the division, I am Bruce Nelson. I'm with ARM. We're an association of providers that support thousands of people with disabilities in the CADI, CAC, TBI, waivers, CDCS, ICFSMR, and some home care. To say the least, Madam Chair and members, I'm very disappointed in the governor's budget. That instead of taking a balanced approach, he chose to balance the budget on the backs of people most in need. People with disabilities, the elderly, people in economic crisis, people without health care, and adding to those roles as well. Now, I'm not elderly yet. I'm getting close. And I don't have a debilitating disability, and I'm fortunate to be fairly healthy, to have a good job, and to have health insurance. So I might see an impact personally, and my family might see an impact on the budget, with this budget proposal, on some of the local government services I get, and my college, my son's college tuition, might see an impact there. And certainly over time, we're on a road to declining quality in Minnesota. But as I said, this budget will hit the most in need, people with disabilities. And this is despite the reform Senator Lori put forward, and I'm sorry Senator Olson had to leave the room, because we did put on the table last year significant reform that will, because it's a very complicated system of rules and regulations and a myriad of funding streams, it's going to take a little bit of time. But we projected by 2012, the legislation that Senator Lori put forward will combine 11 different statutes and rules into one set of standards. This will be extraordinarily more cost effective, and it will turn the system upside down and from a process-oriented system to one that's outcome-driven, it's quality-driven, it's consumer-centered. So we are taking the opportunity, if you will, of the terrible economic situation to try to move forward with reforms, and we will be bringing forth a bill again this year. Senator Lori's bringing forth to take a couple other baby steps until we can get to the big enchilada. I mentioned people with disabilities, but I should also mention their caregivers. ARM alone employs 30,000 caregivers, and we haven't run our numbers yet on how many jobs would be lost, how many hours would be lost, but it's not insignificant. As I mentioned earlier, the elderly, this budget targets the elderly and their caregivers, and people in economic crisis. So this is really bad policy to balance a budget on the backs of these folks, of people, and leave the likes of me, who is fortunate in this economy, to get off relatively scot-free. So I urge the Senate to take a balanced approach that spreads the pain more fairly to people like me, who are fortunate enough to be able to shoulder more of the pain, more of the burden of working through this economic crisis in terms of taxes, in terms of cuts, to the likes of me and others who are more fortunate, rather than focus on those people most in need. I think that's a wrong approach, and it's heading us down a disastrous road. Now, Steve Larson will follow me later from the ARC of Minnesota.
He's going to come on Thursday.
He is going to come on Thursday. Well, he is going to offer many solutions as well that we've been working with him on, and we look forward to bringing forward to you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Denise Miller, to be followed by John Heterick.
Good morning. My name is Denise Miller. I currently work at Unisys Corporation full-time in Roseville. My 24-year-old son Andrew was born with a birth defect. He cannot walk, and so he uses a power wheelchair. He has been ventilator dependent since he was 6 months old. He requires 24-hour per day skilled private duty nursing care. He can turn blue at a moment's notice, which requires nursing intervention immediately. He can turn blue with simple things like laughing, crying, bending over, or eating, just to name a few. He lives at home with us. Since insurance will only pay for 50 hours per year of nursing care, the rest of his private duty care is paid through medical assistance. I am very concerned with the new provider rate cut of 2.5% on top of the 2.58% that was imposed July 1st, 2009. What is the incentive for the nurses to stay and take care of my son? He cannot have a nurse take care of him that just graduated from college. He needs someone that has experience with emergency situations and an intensive level of care. Pay in a hospital is not decreasing. Yes, there are layoffs occurring at area hospitals, but the nurses that care for my son are specialized. They have intensive care background and could easily step right back into the hospital setting. Some people would say that home care nurses have great hours and wouldn't want to go back to the hospital. That is not true. The nurses that take care of my son work nights, weekends, and holidays. The home care nurses get minimal benefits compared to the benefits they could get in a hospital setting. We cannot compete with the hospitals. Keeping these nurses at my house will be difficult with another provider rate cut. Andrew is a viable member of the community. He volunteers daily at Bridgeview School in St. Paul using computer software that enables him to create symbols and picture boards that are used by the students at Bridgeview who cannot speak. These picture boards allow the students to communicate with the other students and the teachers. The special education teachers put in requests to Andrew for these specific boards to be made. This saves the teachers a lot of time they don't have due to increased class sizes. They just love him there. He is transported to Bridgeview via a day training and habilitation program. This transportation service would also be affected by the 2.5% provider rate cut. Thank you for giving me this chance to tell my story. Please do not allow this provider rate cut of 2.5% to go through. This would be devastating to my son and our family.
Any questions? Thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to come.
Thank you, Senator.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Committee.
I guess John Hederick is on his way. We'll take Mary Reagan next.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, which is a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. But I'm not here today in my role as a representative of providers. I'm here in my role as an advocate for children to talk about the cuts to the Children and Community Services Grant that the governor has proposed. This was a cut that he originally enacted through an allotment. He is proposing to continue this in this budget proposal. The Children and Community Services Grant these are the only state dollars that are put into Minnesota's child welfare system. This was created in 2003 by combining a series of children's grants and adult grants. And the focus of these dollars is on vulnerable children and adults who are vulnerable because of abuse, neglect, or disability. In 2003, when this consolidated grant was put together, children lost $50 million in that process. Every 2 years, counties are required to put together a plan that has to be developed with input from the community about how they're going to use these dollars. It needs to be posted on their website, and you can find that for any of your counties. Some examples of how they plan to use these dollars include hiring child protection workers, providing mental health services for uninsured and underinsured children, family support services to prevent further abuse and neglect, including the 11 other state-supervised county-operated states in the country. Minnesota puts the fewest number of state dollars in child welfare. In 2009, there was $68 million in the CCSA account that went to 87 counties. The governor is proposing that there will be $44.5 million left in that account. We recognize that you have major challenges with this budget deficit. We have heard the counties testify that they would support a cut to local county aid instead of this cut to these targeted population. We would also support any efforts to increase revenue and appreciate your work. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Is John Hederick here yet? Maybe he can come back on Thursday also then. So with that, we're a little past our time. I appreciate members staying as long as they did, and we'll be adjourned until tomorrow when we'll resume public testimony on the governor's budget.